air area
yeah.
between, which is now between the university library and the historical society, was the drill ground. And I remember one incident there of the boys who were opposed to the lieutenant or whoever it was, who was a very unpopular man.
Was it Lomo?
Yeah. They got from somewhere a long, what we'd call a hayfork rope, of 1 inch in diameter, manila rope, of the kind used to haul hay up into the barn, 100 feet long, and get 5 people or 6 people on each end of that long rope. And when the squad is marching towards you, you run to them with the rope about 12 inches above the ground and try to trip them, or you do trip them. And the commander didn't like that. He called the police. We had that kind of ruckus, and the right. students stole the rifles from the and shipped them down to Edgerton or something. Right. That kind of behavior. Then in the 90s, over in the women's dormitory, we had a real panty raid, which. Do you remember that one, 1889 or 1898 or 99, something like that? The boys came, it wasn't a panty raid, really. The boys broke into the laundry and took the private underthings of the girls and carried them away. And this caused a great deal of consternation. And I remember we even found a piece in a German language newspaper from Milwaukee that shook its head over that, because these boys, they're going quite beyond the limits of gentlemanly behavior. The women got together and agreed they would have no truck, actually a word they used, no intercourse with the men until the garments were returned. And at that time they could use that term without causing a trouble or a misunderstanding. What that was worked out eventually, there was a future governor of Wisconsin was one of the laundry room raiders, and nobody got sent out, sent home, nobody got expelled. But we were in that thing at the time, just after World War II, when we had the first panty raid, and there was a lot of head shaking, etc. And either you or I, I've forgotten which one, got hold of George, was it George Taylor, the public relations man, and said, for God's sake, why don't you send out the story on Grandpa Did It Too? And the story of the raid in 1898 or 99, we had the exact dates, and he did, and I think it, either the newspapers got tired of the panty raid, or this story just let the air out of the balloon. I preferred to believe that they let the air out of the balloon.
Now we get into the 20th century and we see some of the same types of behavior
yeah.
on the part of students that you might want to mention, things like the bag rushes and the green cap tradition, things like that.
Oh, that's but recurring.
What about academically and in terms of the parental attitude that Professor Curdy talked about, where it was kind of a civic responsibility as a parent? Did that attitude change in the 20th century?
Oh, yes. Don't you think?
I think with Van Hise, beginning Chamberlain and then with Van Hise, the university sought to make itself a real university in terms of supporting original research. Both at the experiment station, there had been beginnings at the experiment station, but I think it wasn't until the late 19th century with Chamberlain in the early 20th century that the research functions of a modern university were recognized and began to be supported. But a great many regents had to be educated by President Van Hise to see the importance of research in terms of a state university. And the regents seemed to feel that anyone who did research must be slighting teaching, and that the fundamental obligation was to teaching. So this was the background of a controversy involving Frederick Jackson Turner, probably the best known member of the faculty in the first decade of the 20th century, who had been given by his friend Van Hise certain privileges for more time for research. Some of the regents resented that. No doubt some of the faculty may have, but some of the regents certainly did. Protested against it. And Turner was always being asked to go to other and more prestigious universities. So in order to keep him here, concessions were made that he could do more research. So the battle for the recognition of research was a very real battle. It just didn't suddenly happen. There was opposition, and there were struggles. And when Turner finally left to go to Harvard in 1910, he wrote a letter to President Van Hise, and he said that he hoped what he had tried to do, unpleasant though it had been for everyone, would pay off in terms of a greater recognition by the university of the importance of research in all fields, as well as in the more purely utilitarian ones. So I think we could say that the history of the university was not merely a prosaic thing which just developed in an orderly fashion. There were many ups and downs, personalities, particularly on the part of the presidents, countered a great deal, the problems of leadership, struggles to get some research supported and recognized. The history becomes all the more interesting because of the fact that the answers weren't all at hand. Had to be worked out pragmatically by experience, and always the legislature in very close to the whole thing, watching. Appropriations necessary. So I think I'm not sure, but it seems to me that this history must have done much more than any history at the time of any other state university in showing something of the struggles mm-hmm. involved mm-hmm. in the development of a public-supported university. Wouldn't you think so?
Yeah, I would think so. I was going to come back on your research problem that you mentioned. In 1892 or 93, the University of Chicago was the new president there with Rockefeller money, whatever the new president was, offered Chamberlain, president of the University of Wisconsin, a professorship of geology at a salary $1,000 larger than he was getting as president here, and with a teaching obligation of something like 3 hours a week. This was a little outrageous. William Freeman Vilas, I think, was on the Board of Regents, and he may have been president of the board, and was indignant that this president at Chicago would hire the president of the University of Wisconsin to become a mere professor and offer him a job like that. And I've often wondered, and I don't think we know anything about this, what effect that had on the will that William Freeman Vilas wrote establishing the Vilas professorships at the University of Wisconsin, which explicitly provide that the professor will teach no more than 3 hours a week.
I think it's a warrantable inference that it has a real influence.
And he sets a salary which is above, or he set a salary which was the size of the salary that lured Chamberlain to Chicago. And Vilas was not the kind of man who thought that a heavy teaching load couldn't be handled, because he taught at the law school and had taught as much as 20 or 25 hours a week. But he was a phenomenon. But I've always liked that kind of connection. But the Vilas experience was not one that the knowledge of Vilas's view had not traveled very far at the time Turner left.
Right.
You mentioned Van Hise and the growth of research. Now, there's another term that becomes many people associate with the University of Wisconsin, and that's the Wisconsin idea. Mm-hmm. In your research, when did you see that idea developing, and how was it given definition in those early years up through, let's say, 1925?
Well, I think there was, from the very beginning, the assumption on the part of the presidents of the university, many of whom were ministers, actually, in background, and some of the regents, that the public support of the university, so far as it was publicly supported, would pay off in terms of what the university would contribute to the state, but it was never made very explicit. But I think it was there in the rhetoric. And I don't know when the term, the Wisconsin idea, first appears. I've always imagined that it was very early in the Van Hise.
Yeah, 1912, I think, with the publication of a book by that title.
By a journalist.
Yeah.
But I was wondering, you think that's the first time that they...
I think, Burrell, you're right, that the notion of really applied learning, you use the knowledge to improve your world, that's talked about almost from the beginning. It's talked about quite seriously by Bascom. It gets a sharper focus with Chamberlain, who will translate the vague idea into things such as the agricultural extension and the other extension. Now he gets it started a little, and then it sags, and then with Van Hise, who was a Chamberlain student, Van Hise manages to build on, I think, on what Bascom had brought, what Chamberlain brought in terms of broad ideas, and what Adams brought in terms of political operation. He got along well with regents and with legislators and with the leading citizens of Madison. And Van Hise takes all of these and charges forward and gets things have to come together right. Van Hise and La Follette. And La Follette wants to use the expertise of the university. The extension people are here, and they're going to educate the whole state. It all works out together. We even have delegations coming from India to study the University of Wisconsin in the first or second decade. It's during the Van Hise period.
Oh yes, talk about politics. You had mentioned La Follette. Let's talk for a moment about the early years of the university in terms of religion and politics. What kind of a role did religion and politics play in the early years? And if you could maybe bring that up into skip up to the Progressive period and talk about the
religion. Of course, there was the provision in the Constitution of 1848. Mm-hmm. Right? Regarding there was to be a separation of church and state as far as public institutions were concerned. At the same time, several of the early presidents of the university had an ecclesiastical background. They had studied for the ministry if they hadn't actually preached, and there was chapel, which was required. By the early 1870s, the students just weren't going to chapel much, and there seemed to be no way of requiring them to, and President Bascom decided that that required chapel should be given up. I guess chapel entirely mm-hmm. should mm-hmm. be given up. Rather than maintain the fiction of chapel when a student didn't come to it, and if we're not incorrect, I think Wisconsin was the first of the state universities that gave up required chapel.
Nobody fretted much about it when they had it. they fretted a little. It was the godless university as far as Beloit and Lawrence and other universities are concerned. Yeah. But they were lucky, the Wisconsin was lucky that they had a number of church-related schools so that the university had an opportunity to grow. Church-related schools that kept one church to from grabbing the federal endowment, which might have happened if we'd been of one persuasion. But Beloit couldn't get it, and they're going to see that Lawrence didn't get it, and so on. I think that may have played an element in it. But the university, even though they had a chapel, they were, you remember, called by the man at Beloit sent us the letters
Eaton,
that
President Eaton
that identified the Wisconsin, the godless state university.
Right.
The politicians had to be taught a little about supporting a state university, because that wasn't quite in the document in their experience. During the 1850s. There was a move in the legislature, not awfully seriously perhaps, but a move to sever the university from the state's payroll, as it were, give it to Dane County and let it be the Dane County High School, which it was. You remember when they got the Ag College grant, the Morrill lands, that the legislature fought for and got, that is, the regents fought for and got assigned to Madison. And from then on, it was kind of touch and go. The legislature for a period seemed persuaded, or a number of them, that the university should live on the income from the land endowment. But then came John Spooner in 1852, if I recall, who sponsored the first piece of legislation, a great piece, which began with the declaration, with a statement that inasmuch as the land was given by the federal government for the support of the university, and the land was sold early and cheap for the benefit of the state, therefore, something to this effect, the state owes the university the difference between what was got for the land and what the land is now worth, that money to be used to support the university. When I first got here, Bill Ebue was saying the same thing in the Cap Times. It was a great statement, and I think substantially correct, that the land endowment was squandered, and if the guardian squanders the inheritance of the orphan, he's required to make up for it, isn't he? And the legislature was asked to make up for it, and I think the legislature liked that solution, because then members could always go back to their community and say, you wouldn't want us to cheat, would you? Or words to that effect. In any event, beginning in the 70s comes the push for among the politicians to get support for the university. And increasingly that becomes an element. I don't say that the university ever supported, that the legislature ever supported the university over generously, but they did pretty well. And as time goes on, you see the regents of Wisconsin and Michigan particularly exchanging notes on how they can get more money out of the legislature.
Right. But going back for just a minute to the problems of religion, as Vernon suggested, the denominational colleges did put in a claim for the Morrill lands. They try to argue that they were better qualified than the University of Madison to properly use these. But I think it wasn't until until President Van Hise's day, around about 1910, that the university officially did, the administration did say, probably the best way of meeting these criticisms that we are a non-religious institution is to encourage the leading churches in Madison to establish student centers.
Well, I'm glad you remember that.
And thus it would be more difficult to claim that the university was completely indifferent to all religion. And they did begin to do this. St. Paul Center was one of the early ones. But I remember that as late as 1945, there were some students who wanted to have religion taught as a formal subject in the university. And it was remembered that the Constitution had been very explicit in its declaration of separation of church and state. And somebody suggested that religion be taught by the chaplains of these centers, and the university give credit for those. The faculty was opposed to that because the faculty felt that it would have no control over the standards of such courses on religion given in these religious centers. And gradually, and without any big rumpus, the university began to introduce courses concerned with religion. Of course, it had always been taught, the history of religion had always been taught in history courses and in literature courses, but I think there began to be, and in philosophy courses, but I think there began to be, I've forgotten what, in Hebraic studies, I think mm-hmm. there began to be taught in Hebraic studies something one could call comparative religion.
Did somebody ever, anybody ever teach the course in the Bible as literature here?
I can't remember. One would have thought somebody might have taught it, and it might have been done, but I
know something like that was done at Iowa, and there's no difficulty with that.
Yeah.
Because it's a qualified scholar doing it.
You mentioned before that several of the early presidents were ministers. I'd just like to turn to some of the early personalities on campus and have either or both of you respond to them. Lathrop is the first one that comes to mind. What did you learn about President Lathrop?
I'm not sure that he was an actual minister, but he...
No.
Could you define... I'm not sure Lathrop was a minister, so we know who you're
talking about. Yeah, I'm not sure.
I can't remember.
I don't think Lathrop was a minister, and I think in that... No, I'm going to back down.
I can't so be
this
sure.
This is something you're going to strike out of your...
We'll start
with Lathrop as a president. He was kind of an itinerant college president, university president. I think he was president of
Indiana,
Missouri.
And then
Wisconsin,
he went back to Missouri.
And then went back to Missouri. And presided... How long did he stay here? Was he the man who admitted women? No, women were admitted during
the
Civil War.
No, that was in the Civil War.
Well, they snuck in before that in the classes on pedagogy.
Yeah.
And then became more numerous during the Civil War. And then were admitted formally. Well, Lathrop was a cautious man, I think. When he came to Madison, he bought pews not in one church but in two. Or maybe he was going to be sure that if he had to go, he'd get to the right place. He also was a minor speculator in land. I think he bought some of the university land at auction. Whether he kept it or not, I don't know. I don't have much an impression of him, except kind of in reverse, where the faculty, after Lathrop left, adopted a resolution at some time or another. You remember a kind of a cloudy one, suggesting that the regents appoint a president, although in their experience he had usually meant nothing more than an extra large salary. Some friendly faculty.
In any case, President Twombly had been a Methodist minister, an active Methodist
minister. Oh, yeah, he's your favorite,
isn't he? And Bascom was qualified as a Congregational minister. And I guess that was...
Do you remember the resolution the regents considered and then declined to approve but still recorded in their minutes about dismissing Twombly?
I'm sure you can
I can't remember, but it's something that he had no capacity, no learning to teach, no capacity to teach, and something else.
No capacity to administer.
Administer. He had three things he didn't have that were needed, but he was celebrated some 20 years ago by a group of students who organized a society, a very bright young mathematician, who had read the book, apparently, read the history. And he organized a society to remember John Twombly and invited everybody to join it. Merle and I appeared as sponsors of the society. and it cost nothing, and within a short time, he had a membership, he claimed, of 10,000 or so. Remember John Twombly, and he was going to name the Peterson, I think it's the Peterson Building, is that the administration building? For John Twombly. Why? Because during John Twombly's period, the president had not increased the tuition of the students. And for a while, he and his gang had, this was while the building was under construction, site of the John Twombly Memorial Building. We were
quite amused by it.
I've forgotten who was chairman. I think Dave Feldman was chairman. I ought to strike that Dave Feldman name. I've forgotten who was chairman of the Building Names Committee. I was a member of it. But one or two of us were going to respond to the petition of 5,000 students that this building be called the John Twombly Building. It's Ed Young. Ed Young was the chairman, so you can strike that out, too. But he wouldn't call a meeting of the committee because he knew he'd lose the vote. And for 2 years, we didn't have a meeting of the Building Names Committee. The chairman was going to prevent John Twombly's name from being...
But Twombly wrote a wonderful... a letter when the regents summarily dismissed him without notice. He said, "I didn't ask to come here. I gave up my Methodist church in the Boston area to come here to be your president. And now you fire me at a time when the Methodist conferences are not meeting, when I can't get another pastor, and I demand financial recompensation." It was a marvelous letter.
And I guess they gave it to him. And he was a member of the Board of Overseers of Harvard, and so he's a man of some standing, but a total incompetent when it came to running the university, apparently. Sterling
became acting.
He was a staunch man who apparently held the things together. Who's that anti feminist? I had him a minute ago. Who was president?
Yes.
We have the girls' hall.
Chamberlain. No. Chadburn.
Chadburn was unwilling to come here as long as they had coeducation. And the reason they put Chadburn Hall way down here in the corner, the girls said, was to keep them isolated from the rest of the campus. At that time,
North and South Hall.
Park was the extreme end of the campus. And the girls also said he was going to put a high fence all around it. Well, Twombly had his female college set up separate from the regular college, and it worked, I think, as a separate little college for a while, but he didn't stay very long. When he left, all this absurdity departed.
It had some lady instructresses.
Yeah. And then the women moved into the classes and began to get all the good grades. And the boys denounced them for that.
Could you, either of you, relate the story of the naming of Chadbourne Hall with President Burge, I think?
Oh, yeah.
I think we tell the
Burge
story.
Told that story to us about Chadbourne Hall. And it was forgotten who it was that proposed it. He went a Bascom daughter, I think. And he said he named it Chadbourne Hall, or proposed Chadbourne Hall, as a punishment for Chadbourne for having opposed female education. And it amused Burge still that the regents accepted the name, and that for all it was eternity, or for the immediate future, Chadbourne would be attached to the finest girls' residence hall in Wisconsin. I kind of like that kind of vengeance on a man.
Professor Curdy, you talked before about Bascom, and I know that you wrote the chapter on President Bascom. Could you just give a brief summary of some of the highlights of the contributions that John Bascom made to the university?
Yes, I think Bascom, representing some of the in many ways most humanistic traditions of his time, thought of the unity of all knowledge. He didn't like the growing specialization that separated one subject completely from some other subject. He felt that knowledge was inseparable and shouldn't be fragmented. He had an organic conception of the unity of knowledge. This was not unique. I think this was in the tradition going back at least to the Renaissance. But he gave instruction and wrote textbooks in mental philosophy, or he actually used the term psychology, Christian ethics, economics, what he called political economy, was economics and political science. He gave instruction on all of these courses, and to seniors, as was customary in the day in liberal arts colleges, an overall subject on the evidences of Christianity, perhaps under a slightly different topic, in which he showed, again, bringing all knowledge together, including science. He was interested in, without committing himself completely for or against, the theories of evolution. In this senior course, he attempted to show the interrelationships between knowledge and the Hebraic Christian conception of ethics and the contributions of the Greeks to humanistic ethics. And students who took this course often referred to it as being perhaps the best part of the education they got at Wisconsin. But he wrote these many books. He was, like Trombley and others, dismissed by the university from the presidency and went back to Williams College, where he taught the subjects he'd been teaching here. He did come back for a commencement, and
La Follette met him, didn't
and
he?
La Follette met him, and he came back for a commencement. And did he get an honorary degree?
I think so.
He got an honorary degree. I think the university sort of felt a bit ashamed of his treatment, of his rather shabby treatment, and the way in which he was dismissed. But I think his contribution was what we would now call general education. And he disliked the separation of science from the humanities and the social studies. He felt that they were all interrelated. And in a way, this was the philosophy that Meckeljohn had when he started the experimental college, that is the unity of knowledge and the interrelation of different kinds of knowledge, or our own integrated liberal studies. Well, I think Bascom must have been a very remarkable teacher, and his zest for learning was certainly very real and very genuine.
And he gave it, didn't he, the impression I get is that he brought a sense of standards yes. to the university. There are a lot of universities in the 1870s and 80s.
Were
pretty sloppy, but Bascom gave them some sense.
Yes, he did.
Of what ought to be involved in learning.
Right.
And didn't La Follette sing Bascom's praises in his autobiography?
So, yes. Very much so.
And mm-hmm. elsewhere.
Mm-hmm. Well, Bascom sort of laid the groundwork then for. I know that you told me in our last interview that Chamberlain became one of your favorites over time.
Yeah.
Could you talk for just a moment, just as Professor Curdy did, about the contributions of Chamberlain to the university?
Well, Chamberlain was a geologist, but he was a man of, seemed to me, a really spacious outlook. He accepted such the notions of Bascom, of high standards, but he had he was more of a I won't say more of. He was simply interested in learning in all respects and in research. And he had the idea that, he wasn't afraid of anything because it was old, and he wasn't afraid of anything that was new. The only test he wanted to apply was whether it would contribute to making a better university. And he had the idea of extension work in agriculture, in industry, and for general knowledge. All of these things he wrote about, only two were, he saw very little of anything except the beginnings of agricultural extension. There was a little engineering extension work, but that didn't go, and a little public lecture business, but they didn't have the mechanism. That would come under Van Hise. And what was needed there was not the idea, but the means of carrying it forward. And then it was under Chamberlain, too, that the graduate school gets organized.
Yeah. And Chamberlain felt that the PhD was at least an outward and visible sign of having met certain standards of scholarship. And when Turner wanted to be promoted without having got a PhD, Chamberlain was insistent that this couldn't be. He would have to go to the Johns Hopkins, which was the principal prestigious university for PhDs, and get his PhD before he could hope for professorial standing here. I think that's an example of Chamberlain's insistence that there are such things as scholarship and research qualifications. They can be measured, and there are minimal measurements, and if anyone wanted to be a professor here, they must meet these.
And there is somewhere we found, picked up, correspondence between Wilson, who was president of, Woodrow Wilson, who was president of Princeton at the time, and Chamberlain. And there are some Wilson letters, I think, along with some Roosevelt letters in our archives. But Wilson had said that Chamberlain was one of the best judges of men anywhere in the country, and that in getting new members to his for his faculty, he looked to see who Chamberlain appointed and then hired him because he had more money. Which you remember that one?
Yeah,
which I thought was a very nice and more flattering than I thought Wilson was able to be of other people.
Now, you said that Chamberlain laid a lot of the groundwork, and Van Hise provided the mechanism.
Yeah.
Could you define that, but maybe start out by saying who the first PhD from the University of Wisconsin was, because it sort of ties
The first PhD from the University of Wisconsin was Van Hise, with Chamberlain as his major professor, who was president and apparently still teaching. I don't know how you... really talk about the who invents the mechanism, but in extension you could probably get it as well, as clearly as anywhere. In 1904 and 5, Charles McCarthy, maybe I'm my dates are a year or two off, down the Legislative Reference Library, was worried about the number of proprietary schools that were selling correspondence courses, other courses in the state of Wisconsin. And somebody asked him to make a survey. It's McCarthy who starts the Van Hise on the business of extension. Van Hise initially didn't want to go, but McCarthy picks up the makes a survey. Surveys aren't necessarily recent. Finds out that umpty $100,000 a year are being spent by young people to learn mathematics, to learn doing blueprints, mechanical drawing, et cetera, from these proprietary schools, and not all of them are reliable. Why not have the university, which is teaching farm kids this and that, why not have the university establish its correspondence courses and other extension work? Well, he gets the information, he gets to the governor, and as you look through some of the McCarthy information, McCarthy is going to see that a director is appointed to organize an extension division for the university if Van Hise doesn't, even though McCarthy is down here in the
Legislative
State Library.
Reference Bureau.
And this is part of the genius of Van Hise, too, who could see when he was being pushed and not resist. And Van Hise decided to capitulate and then went for a first class. Well, he got a few people in to kind of start it, but then he got the man who would organize it, an engineer from Penn State. One of us ought to remember the name, who comes with, takes a year to plan the correspondence courses and the other programs for extension. Now, what you have is Van Hise being pushed, Van Hise being bright and quick and selecting a man after he turned down two or three that McCarthy wanted. And that's probably is the difference between making a success out of extension and a failure, because I think a couple of those that McCarthy wanted would have organized a little show but wouldn't have gotten the big structure that the director who was there for 25 years of extension, what he brought out, and he provided the mechanism for that. Well, then in agriculture you have something else going, the county agents developing, that's something else that was invented, and in grad school you have ultimately a graduate school emerging. All these things keep bubbling up during the Van Hise administration as ways of getting done things that Chamberlain had wanted to do. And then in between them were those two was Adams, who'd done such a magnificent job of being friendly to everybody.
And when Van Hise died unexpectedly, he was succeeded by
Burge. Yeah. And Burge, who had come here in the 1870s and who had studied with the great Swiss naturalist.
Agassiz.
Would you believe that?
Who came in the 1840s. Maybe 30s.
And Burge once told us, didn't he, or did he write this, that when he faced the problems after World War One of the difficulties of returning veterans, of inflation and so on, he remembered what had happened after the Civil War.
I would like to propose that we take just a short break here.
What time is it getting to be?
It's about 3 o'clock.
Do we have about 20 more minutes or so? I just want to talk, the one area which we have neglected somewhat is the faculty. And I'd like to get back and talk a little bit about that early faculty and then wrap it up.
Yeah, you should turn us off the air for the moment so I can say something. Okay. I want to.
No. Something in rhetoric. in connection with the such debating as they may have had. So I think that we have to think of very limited offerings. There was no history. Whatever history was taught as ancient, as Greek and Roman history by whoever was teaching.
Yeah, Alan Turner's teacher.
It wasn't until 1867 that we had an historian, and William F. Allen came. He had been trained at Harvard and some graduate work in German universities, and he had a very broad conception of history, including not only ancient history but modern history. He gave a distinguished scholar, giving lectures at Johns Hopkins and at the Lowell Institute in Boston, and writing some 800 or 900 reviews for The Nation, which was a very prestigious journal.
And he collected slave ballads.
And he collected slave ballads and say the spirituals. So he was one of the first really distinguished scholars, I guess, that the university had in terms of national reputation. But Bascom, who taught everything except the sciences, and he taught even what we would call the history and philosophy of science, I think primarily was a lecturer, just as the classics teachers taught the texts without very much consideration of literature. I think they were grammarians and interested in grammar and the discipline of the language. The lecture method, I think, was Bascom's method. Oh, I think he did try to have some discussion, but his classes were large, especially the senior class. So I don't know how much discussion actually there was. I think it was primarily probably lectures. But I don't know much about the teachings of the sciences. We know that their laboratory equipment was meager, and that they had to struggle to get whatever. The science which first attracted some attention was astronomy. Where I guess
they got the Washburn
Laboratory. The gift of the Washburn Laboratory did give the University of Wisconsin some standing in astronomy.
Not only that, the astronomy sold the time signal to the newspaper, railroads.
To the railroads.
Up until the 1880s.
Which was, again, an example of what later was to be thought of as a Wisconsin idea.
Yeah.
So I think probably the instruction was not completely was very similar to that given in other institutions, with very little emphasis on student investigation. I don't think papers were part of it. The students learned to do what we would think of now. If they went in for debating, there they had to do something like research. I think it was pretty much the conception of the professor has the knowledge and he hands it out to the students. I don't think there was a great deal of active thinking on the part of the students as far as their instructors were concerned. They got more of that in the literary societies and in the debates. But certainly these scholars had the conception of the importance of knowledge, and they devotedly and genuinely believed that what they were doing was important, that they had something to give, and I think most of them were very very sincere in wanting to do the best that the situation permitted. There were many reorganizations of the university, and a good deal of lacking of what we would call stability, and it was some time before the students were prepared really to do real college work of any advanced sort. But I have the feeling that Bascom's books were certainly well known, so that by the 1870s the university was known through him and his books. And I guess the astronomy and probably beginning the agricultural experiments. gave the university some national standing.
I have only a couple of tidbits to offer on the faculty. One involves James Davies Butler, who taught down little Quaker College in Indiana for a while and then was invited here by, I think in the 1850s, to teach Greek and Latin. And there's a letter, a couple of letters in the Butler file to a relative in the East. One of them raising the question of why he would leave a good, respectable Christian college to go to a godless university. And his response was that because of the possibility that the university would dismiss all of its faculty or would go bankrupt or something. He said, well, he was going to get a much higher salary, double his stated salary by going to Wisconsin. And that was great, and he'd have students here. Where he was, he didn't have many students, and even though they stated a salary, he never collected any. And so the chances of his losing anything in Wisconsin weren't very good. Well, he stayed until the reorganization of the 60s, and then became a writer for railroad promotion.
Yes, a kind of a freelance writer.
And what, in the age when he was past 70, he went to China and traveled up the Yangtze River. He's a great character. Yeah.
He must have been a rather colorful figure.
The other one, I don't know where I picked up this story, but it involves Schlichter's coming to teach mathematics. He had a master's from Northwestern, I think. Bascom hired him to come up and teach mathematics. He came, a young man. I'm not sure whether he's married yet. I think he may have been. Beginning his academic career. First year was here, Bascom announced that he'd come in and visit class at a stipulated time, and he came, stayed the whole hour, and then asked Schlichter to come and talk to him later. Schlichter went in, and Bascom gave him a critique of his teaching, told him what he did well, what he did poorly, and told him that he'd be teaching here again another year. The second year, Bascom again told him he'd come in at a certain date to visit his class. He a class. He came. He visited and asked Schlichter to come and come in and talk to him. And again, there was criticism of what he'd done well and what he'd done badly. And then Bascom told him he would now be a professor.
So well, that was the right thing. No academic tenure sense of the word.
And he moves immediately from instructor to professor, having passed the president's check.
Most of the presidents until Van Hise, I don't know about Chamberlain, but they were rather paternalistic, I think, in their attitude toward the faculty.
Mm-hmm. Now, you mentioned that there's a great deal of, I guess, rote would be one way of saying it, with the learning and faculty students. When did a change come about in that attitude?
Apparently, it probably differed in different departments.
Yeah, and somehow. Probably begins in the 1890s, wouldn't you gather?
I think so.
I think Turner coming from coming back from Hopkins with a PhD. Yeah. I think Ely coming in with his experience in German universities, Chamberlain with his view. I'd suppose in the social sciences it's coming in. Van Hise, according to Vance, as I remember Vance in bits, Van Hise is taking his students on field trips. And you get that kind of exchange. So I'd suppose the late 1880s, 1890s is the time it's going.
It seems to be less parochial and traditional in the old sense of the small college.
But now you go and probably find us wrong on that.
But I was wondering if it corresponded at all with the research emphasis of...
I'd suppose that...
I would think so.
I'd suppose it would be quite a bit of correspondence.
Turner's emphasis on having his students use the primary sources in the Historical Society.
Yeah.
Allen had begun that in the 1880s, but it was very unusual, I think, anywhere. I think with Turner making a great point of teaching even undergraduates from the original sources and putting the right papers.
What about women on the faculty? When did they first begin to assume a fairly active role?
Well, I don't know. When the home economics people were the first ones, there were...
I don't think you'd ever say they had an active role before probably the 1970s or 80s, yes. If there have been active. There were women from time to time. The generation of Helen White had a number of women, and then for a long period there were no women coming up. Women had kind of gave up, didn't they, after Helen White's generation?
No women in the history department until when was Diane appointed?
It'd be after 1964.
It was well after that.
Mm-hmm. Probably.
1970s. There were, in the English department, I think by the early part of the present century, the English department sort of lifted itself by the bootstraps. And they had some very good scholars who were called to Yale and other places. But I think Cairns was the great innovator in the study of American literature. A few years ago, the 100th anniversary of the first teaching of American literature in an American university was observed here. Leslie Fiedler came, and to my sadness, spoke very disrespectfully of the man who had done so much to promote American literature, Harry Hayden Clark. It was in such bad taste. Harry Hayden Clark directed an innumerable number of useful.
He had 70 or 80, didn't he?
Yes, and they were, you know, good, substantial, good solid, good substantial things. Mm-hmm. I think by the early part of this century, I can't remember it was an Elizabethan scholar who went to Yale.
Yeah. But there were a few in home ec and a few in science, one or two of the sciences.
I think there must have been a few in science.
Yeah.
One or two more questions on the faculty, then we'll wrap it up. The term faculty governance is one that is used a lot in association with UW. When did that term begin to acquire real substance?
The story is told that during the Civil War, when there was no president, faculty began to have some spirit and some control.
They had to do whatever was done.
But I think that really it probably comes later with the Van Hise period. When you get faculty who are faculty made up or faculty having a fairly large number of persons who are towering scholars in their own right and who are concerned with the welfare of the institution, as Turner was, for example. Turner's interest not only embraced what was going on in the history department,
but in athletics.
Athletics and extension.
And extension.
He has one excellent article letter to Van Hise on what the extension department ought to be and do. And when you have a faculty with wide interest and faculty members who are themselves maybe as important as the president, then they do have meetings that are important, and when they speak, the president listens. At least that's what they hope.
The other term that is often talked about by faculty traditionally is academic freedom. Could you just discuss that concept of UW's history for briefly?
Well, of course, this conception is generally attributed to the 19th century German universities, Lehrheit, and I think it came into America as Americans went and got their PhDs in German universities and came back and began to staff American universities. And I think they probably the idea had existed before, but I think the term academic freedom tended to be an offshoot of that. I think that there probably were individual cases where what professors taught was challenged by either students or
parents, regents.
Or
politicians.
But I don't think it was, greatly formalized in any way, institutionalized. And until the Van Hise period.
Well, we get the great Ely case.
The Ely case in 1893 or 1894.
Yeah, and there you get the statement that Adams wrote for the Regents Committee on the fearless sifting and winnowing.
And Ely had been a product of German universities himself.
And in that one, you get the classic statement, which in many ways. Particularly since the students of the class of, 1910 got that statement out. And you've seen the Ted Herforth article on that, and nailed it to the wall of Bascom. It became a declaration for all to see. I remember...
Then it was challenged, you remember.
We didn't really get sued for libel when Volume 2 came out. It became a kind of statement.
Yeah.
I remember who was the man who edited the La Follette magazine for so the Progressive for so long. He I think died a year or two ago. He said he came here as a student from New York. Got off the railroad station, walked up to the university, walked up the hill, Bascom Hill, and saw that statement on the wall. And he said, "This is the place for me," and he never left Madison. Well, that statement, I heard the wife of a regent once told me, that has given the regents more trouble than anything in this century, because every time they do something that they think they ought to do that maybe restricts those wild people over in Madison, somebody yells they're violating their academic freedom. Well, what's involved here, of course, is the thing that's absolutely correct. If you're going to explore ideas, there must be a freedom to explore them fully. And honestly, and completely, and that's the thing that the great plaque.
Yes, and, of course, this goes back to the Greeks.
Oh yeah,
the Greeks and John Stuart and Mill and a lot of others.
A lot of other others too.
Nice to have it sitting there, reminding.
That's right. Today. That's right.
You ended the history in the year 1925. Why did you say?
Yes.
Because we didn't even know we
Could
were going
to put that in context.
Yeah, we didn't. We fixed 1925. That was the end of the Burge administration. We were flat out going full speed, and we didn't know we were going to be able to get that far in time to make this the centennial. Now, you've got a lead time, which the press wanted, of about a year and a half for the manuscript to get to them. That means we've to be published in early 49. Actually, the first volume got out in 48, I think.
Yeah.
We have to be through in 47.
Yeah.
And we felt that we were we'd done more than we could do. And if Merle Curdy hadn't been capable of doing two men's work or three, we'd have never made it. As it was, we ended in 25. Now, if we had gone beyond 25, we'd gotten into the a tremendously complicated period of the 30s,
right.
The Depression and the 30s, the dismissal of Glenn Frank, and all of the problems involved there. That's going to be a terrific
And we knew we couldn't do anything more than the most superficial part of it.
Yeah.
Anything we would do after that would be disgracefully superficial.
We had to look at
stop.
Be aware of what's happening nationally. We had to be aware of what's happening within the various disciplines nationally. We had to go through the newspapers and the legislative stuff and so on. It's a whale of a lot of tons of material, and we thought we were darn lucky to have
held as far as
a part of our sanity and some of our health to have gotten to 1925.
How was the book generally received?
We got very good reviews.
I think we got good reviews.
And we liked it. We got one bad review, which we didn't like.
What was that one?
It was something in the... this wonderful thing about Merle Curdy. We get threatened with a libel suit, and the guy's going to throw us in jail. And Merle laughed happily after that one. We got a bad review, and Merle took that seriously for a while. But this was in that professor of higher education who didn't like our index.
Another Allen.
Who didn't like our index.
Oh, he didn't like our index.
One of the things I liked about it, this kind of, don't take it too seriously, but I kind of liked it. About 5, 6, 7 years after the book was published, I met one of the regents whose name won't come back to me. Who said he'd read the books and quite enjoyed them, and that I might be amused at the fact that Governor Rennebaum, who was a member of the Regents then, and I know he had been given Volume 1 as governor and told he'd get Volume 2 as soon as he finished reading Volume 1. The governor read him, and the awful thing this regent told me was the governor read him, and when he became a regent, he remembered him. And when the regents would get excited about certain things, Rennebaum would say, oh, hell, Curdy and Carstensen tell you about when that happened in such and such a time. Don't make the same kind of mistake the regents made then. This in connection with the misbehavior of students at Randall against the military. And Rennebaum remembered that case in the 1880s down here and said, all the regents do is make it worse, so stay out of it. What do you suppose we hire the president for and these other people? This chap who was telling me the story concluded, he said, the time you would really have been amused, I'm sorry you weren't there, was LVM had a proposition that he wanted to bring to the regents. And he finished making the proposition and turned to Rennebaum and said, I don't care what Curdy and Carstensen say, I want it this way. Which I thought was one of the
nicest
reviews we had.
Yeah, that's very nice.
Cut. I promised you a half an hour, and I made it up in 20 minutes. So that.
A footnote, and I was the guilty one. I had quoted something from the president of Stanford at the time. David Starr Jordan, who said that Allen was a capable man but had cheated at the cards. I didn't know that was libelous. How would I know? It just seemed good figure of speech.
Always use this in my seminars to tell students that in quoting,
we never found out whether that would be libelous or not, because that was an educational recommendation, and an educational recommendation is not libelous or comment. Well, with this, E.B. Fred was a little fretful.
He was quite upset.
And the regents were not altogether happy because they had the copyright to the damn book.
I think they did consult the lawyer's attorney or the attorney
general. They sent us down to the attorney general sent us to an assistant attorney general. You remember that chap who was a great cook.
Right.
And we went down with Tom Webb. And Tom was fretful about it.
Oh, he was very fretful.
But Merle was just blithe as anything. He knew that we were going.
I didn't think anything could come of it.
Well, we were rather hoping we could goad him into a lawsuit, because that would bring attention to the book. And we thought it'd be great to have a university history sued for libel. But the lawyer was cautious. And he helped prepare letters. I remember he said, avoid an excess of clarity and something else in writing to the guy. He's pretty old, isn't he? He writes this way. I said, you look at the stuff he wrote in 1914. It's the same. He hasn't aged a minute. At some time, this lawyer agreed that if we went to jail, he'd get Tom Webb a cell adjoining ours. And Tom didn't know whether he was fooling or not.
Tom didn't know whether he would like to be next to us.
But as it worked out, with his lawyer writing these long, obfuscating letters, Alan first agreed not to have the whole book, both volumes, withdrawn. He'd be satisfied to have one volume withdrawn, volume two. Then he wanted the chapter taken out. And then he wanted the page taken out. And then he was down to a point where he wanted the footnote changed if we ever published again. And that we agreed to do. Along with the fact that Webb would find all the people he knew who had bought a copy of the book would get a note saying, would you obliterate everything in volume, in footnote so-and-so.
And here's something to paste over.
The chairman of our department then, Chet Eason, actually got that note and got his pen and inked out.
I discovered that. I was having dinner at the Eason's, and there were the two volumes. I decided to pick it up and maybe inadvertently. And there I saw he had painfully pasted that over.
There
was something to paste over it or to ink it out. We had agreed, if the book was ever published again, to change the footnote.
And that was done.
And when Ed Young decided to run a new edition, Tom wrote to me and he wrote to you, and we had agreed to change the footnote, and I think I undertook to make the change. He said, Alan's dead, why not let it go? And in a way, that's right, but you know, you can't tell. We might meet Alan again sometime. Yeah. But in that connection...
But we had we had both, at least I had assumed, I think Vern had assumed, that he was long since dead when this was in 1914, and this was 1945 or 6.
48, that he was, 48 or 49, 50. The other thing is that Alan Nevins organized the Oral History Project in New York, in Columbia. And among the first people that he worked, first persons he went to, was this fellow... Alan, because of Alan's work in surveying municipalities and school districts. And I talked to the young man who subsequently went to work for Ford, who did the Alan oral history. And he said, oh, you're Vernon Carstensen. I've heard a lot about you and a fellow by the name of Merle Curdy. So where'd you hear about us? Well, I've been working with Alan and taking his account. And every damn time I go to talk to him, he spends the first 30 minutes denouncing those two characters in Wisconsin who had said the nasty things about him. And that I've been intending to get hold of that part of Alan Nevins' stuff. Yeah. Well, that's your...
That's the story.
That is indeed my story. Could I get you both to...
sign of releasing?
No. We don't know yet what we're releasing.
What are we releasing?
Everything.
Well, are you?
My explain.
Yeah, basically there's three kinds of uses that